Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 129, I'm joined by Dr. Lisa Olmos-Deku. We discuss several surgical topics, including the Argus implant, utilizing silicone oil, and scleral buckling pearls. Today's shameless plug, we will be conducting a first-ever online content for ophthalmologists, marketing, and education course at the American Academy of Ophthalmology annual meeting in Chicago. The course will be on Monday, October 29th at 4:30 p.m. in room N136. I will be on the panel with Drs. Osiwuma Obugo, Rahul Khurana, Steve Christensen, and Matthew Weed, and we will cover it all in that hour, so you don't want to miss it. It should be fun and educational. Please, please come and support us. If you have any questions, you can always reach out to me directly. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by Dr. Lisa Olmos-Deku. Dr. Olmos-Deku is Associate Professor of Ophthalmology at the University of Washington in Seattle, Washington. She also serves as the head of the Retina Division and the Fellowship Program Director for the Vitreoretinal Surgical Fellowship there. Dr. Olmos-Deku, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Jay, and it's a real pleasure, and please call me Lisa.
Okay. Well, Lisa, it's your first time on the program, and usually new guests on the program, what we do is we start by getting an idea of what their backstory is and how they ended up where they are today. So when you look back and when you think about your path, at what point did you decide you wanted to be an ophthalmologist and then a retina specialist?
Well, I always knew I wanted to go into medicine. I actually came from a medical family, a lot of medical professionals and allied health professionals in my family. So patient care was top on my list. And when I went to medical school, it became obvious immediately that I loved working with my hands. I knew I wanted to be a surgeon. I loved the fine motor tasks and kind of the thrill of surgery and that sense of accomplishment when a surgery is well done. But I wasn't necessarily thinking ophthalmology. In fact, because my mother is actually an ophthalmologist, I thought, well, let me do something a little bit different. Let me make my own, forge my own path. But naturally, I think I wound up gravitating back toward ophthalmology. I was in a lab at Baylor College of Medicine in the ocular surface lab, so a cornea lab, and I realized that eyes are beautiful, eyes are cool, and I realized I started having things in common to talk with my mom about, and I realized how special it would be if we could be in the same field. And so then I was lucky enough to match her residency at Bascom-Palmer, and from there, I was pretty much destined to become a retina surgeon because there so many strong and inspiring retina faculty.
You took a slightly non-traditional path. You did get an MBA in the course of your training. What were the motivations behind doing that? What value do you think it's added to your career now that you're a retina specialist in academia?
Well, I decided to get my MBA while I was in med school at Baylor in Houston. And it actually happened coincidentally. I was hungry. It was lunchtime. There was an informational session over lunch with free pizza. It turns out that Rice University next door was starting up a combined MD-MBA program, and they were offering really great scholarships for Baylor Med students. And if you know me, you might know that I find it really hard to turn down a good bargain, and I knew nothing about business. And I hadn't taken any time off previously, and I hadn't strayed from the straight and narrow path, and I thought it would be a fun challenge, and I should just apply. Luckily, I got in, and I decided to do it. And I just poured myself into business. I think that it's helped me not just professionally, but also just socially understanding how our world works, how our capitalist society works. Probably my two favorite and most useful classes were communications and strategy. Communications is just so helpful, delivering lectures, teaching lectures, teaching residents and fellows, presenting research. I use communications every single day, the principles I learned, and also with strategy. Learning how to negotiate, learning how to consider other people's motivations and interests can help you basically navigate and climb the academic ladder, and how to make long-term plans. So I think it's been tremendously helpful for me.
I feel like everything we do along the way does add value. And you've, again, done something which, when people come out of their fellowship, and I think you've seen that maybe with your trainees, everyone really fixates on what their first job is going to be, with this idea that, you know, your first job is super, super important. You're going to be there for the next 40, 50 years. And I think that we all have this perception coming out of fellowship, but then you do realize things are fluid, especially in academia. And you're someone who was previously at University of Southern California immediately after your fellowship at Doheny when they were combined, and then subsequently have moved on now to become the chief of the retina division in Seattle. Tell us a little bit about, you know, the pros and cons, the challenges maybe of changing departments mid-career, but maybe some of the benefits you've seen in terms of maybe being exposed to a different environment, different group of people, and how that can kind of be academically enriching.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. But first off, let me just say that as retina specialists, all of us are colleagues. So it doesn't matter where we practice, if we're in academics or in private practice or somewhere in between, we're all colleagues and part of a relatively small group of people. So sometimes, for whatever reason in your life, you need to change jobs or an opportunity arises, and I think it's wonderful that we can all remain close colleagues. When I took my first job after I finished chief here at Bascom at Doheny, I was single, I was unmarried, and I was really open geographically to anything. And I thought it was really exciting to move to Southern California, where I had never lived before. I didn't really have any connections. And just take on an exciting new challenge with a great group of colleagues, and I'm so glad I did. I became involved in the Argus project, which was one of the most valuable things that has ever happened to me. And then life happened, and probably the most important change of all is that I became a parent. So my husband and I, we decided to take a step back, you know, go back to strategy in business school, start thinking about your long-term plans. And those long-term plans for educating our children, raising them, and having some support to do that so that we could continue our careers. Because I think when you become a parent, geography starts to play a really important role in the location of family members who can give that kind of support. So, again, luck plays a big role, and I just happened to be fortunate that the right opportunity came up at the right time for me. I had been at USC for 5 years, and a position opened up at University of Washington for fellowship program director, as well as heading up the division, and that was something that I felt ready for, a leadership role at that time in my career. And of course, retina fellowship education is one of my passions. So I had been in that role at USC. I wanted to continue that. And to be icing on the cake, my chairman's research interests aligned perfectly with what I had been doing at USC. In addition, my husband's family was in the Seattle area. So it all lined up. The stars aligned for me. It just happened at the right time.
You referenced getting involved in the Argus, and USC was one of the first sites. Obviously, Mark Humayun, who was on faculty with you, and like you said, one of our colleagues in the field of retina, was very instrumental in developing the Argus II. Tell us a little bit about your experience with the Argus II and kind of the lessons you take for it going forward. What do you see in terms of the future of this technology or similar technologies?
Right. Well, to take it back one step, I just, again, happened to be in the right place at the right time with the right training to take on the role of PI and lead surgeon on the Argus clinical trial. And then the Argus was FDA approved in 2013. And in 2014, I had the amazing honor of doing the first commercial implantation surgery on the West Coast. And at that time, that was a very special experience for me. I'll never forget it. At the time, I was 36 weeks pregnant with my daughter, and my glove size had swelled from a 6.5 to an 8, and there were reporters and cameras everywhere. Our very own Dr. Gregory flew out from Miami to be there and observe. And so that was the launch of something really important for me. And being an Argus doctor and part of the Argus team is an amazingly emotional experience, and the vision restoration that you can provide to RP patients is just so important to them emotionally too. And so that kind of ignited my passion for vision restoration for retinal degenerations. And there are so many exciting avenues for that field now, not only with the retinal prosthetics, but also now with gene therapy with Luxturna that is happening around the country with many of our colleagues. And stem cells are on the horizon. At University of Washington here, you know, we're working really hard on chemical photoswitches, which is a really exciting drug delivery based method for turning non-photoreceptor cells that are still viable, into light-sensing cells and then potentially restoring sight in people who've lost their vision already from advanced retinal degeneration. So there are so many techniques that we can use, and I'm so happy that there are so many techniques, and I hope to remain involved in as many of them as I can to try and find the best path for patients.
You talked about you're the fellowship director. That's one of the positions you took upon when you came to Washington. Staffing fellows is simultaneously super rewarding and can be very, very challenging. I think it's one of those things that experienced staffing fellows is super helpful, and you're someone who has much more experience than I've had. If you were giving me advice for someone who's staffing fellows or first couple of years out, what sort of advice do you give from the attending point of view? How do you really guide someone while simultaneously managing, good outcomes? What sort of progression do you typically employ for your fellows? Do you have something that's structured where different parts of the year you do have them do different things? Or do you kind of individualize your approach depending on the fellow?
That's a great question. I'm going to take it back to business school. Communications. I think communication is key, and every fellow is different. They're going to have different experiences, different natural skill levels. It's going to be a little bit different. I love it when a fellow takes ownership of a case, so a case that they've seen in clinic and really know, and they've had, personal contact with a patient. I learn a lot from my fellows, so I don't have a regimented set program that I do at the beginning of the year. I do this, and then I move on to do that. I like the fellow to do as much as they can, and during it, we're talking it through. I'll ask them, okay, what should we do next? Let's think about it. Let's try this. And then, sometimes I'll say, well, why don't you let me, I'll try this part, and then we go back to it. So I switch. There's not just one switching. Sometimes I'll switch back and forth with different steps. I think my biggest piece of advice to give for teaching fellows would be to keep an open mind and open ears and try and listen, because sometimes fellows have a lot to teach us. They can look at a case in a different way than you might do, and they might see a key to success in a case. And they are in the process of building their skills, and that is a really important time and a really vulnerable time. So it's important to support them and be positive. And likewise, if you see that there's a part that's proving difficult, do step in and switch and support them, and then pass it back on over. They'll get there and they'll appreciate it.
What sort of cases do you think are maybe the most difficult for the fellows you've seen, or maybe the things that are towards the end of the fellowship fellows still master or maybe continue to master when they leave?
There are cases when there's so many steps and you can get burned out.
Yes.
For example, let's say you have to do a lensectomy, you have to drain choroidals, the iris is sneaked down, the cornea peters out. All these things are happening, and then in addition to that, you have a tough PVR, stiff retinal detachment under it all, and you have to do so many things just to get to the detachment to fix it. That you can really lose steam and lose your stamina and get sort of burned out even just on one case. I'm a big believer in efficiency. We all said if you operate longer than a certain amount of time, you might be operating on yourself. And you do need to be efficient for the sake of the cornea not giving out on you as well. Although I have to credit one of my fellows and I developed this bandage contact lens technique, which really helps prolong the life of a cornea on these type of cases. Jeff Tan, who's now in practice in LA. But I think that, you know, when you, it's a nice part about operating with a fellow is that when someone is burning out, the other person can kind of step in.
Right,
and
right.
That team approach can really be helpful.
Yeah, I'm going to roll it back in a second and ask you about that contact lens technique. I know that wasn't really on our list of topics. That's actually a fascinating, really smart way to approach those cases. But I completely agree with you. I think that you just referenced, for example, lensectomy, sneaked pupil, PVR detachment. And this is going to feed into a different topic we're going to talk about. But like you said, keeping all the steps in your head, not only performing the steps physically, but not forgetting to do anything. And that's a case, for example, if you leave them aphakic and you're putting silicone oil, that many of us would believe that you should put a peripheral iridectomy or iridotomy to prevent the blurry block potentially. And that's something you could easily forget at the end of a 2-hour surgery if you're not, you know, very vigilant. Like you said, it's helpful sometimes to have another person, whether it's the fellow with the attending or the attending with the fellow, to kind of remember that there are the different things to do. I mean, I think the other types of cases that I found that can be particularly challenging, like you talked about, was in terms of length, is for example, like a diabetic TRD, just knowing not necessarily what to do, but how much to do. And I think that there's a tendency. One of my attendings in fellowship, for example, this is a different topic. He used to talk about pneumatic retinopexy, but I remember the first time I did a cryo in the clinic, I asked him, you know, I'm not sure if I did enough. And he always said, he's like, you know, in general, most fellows or most people who are starting do too much. It's not that it's rare that they undertreat. It's more often that you overtreat, because when you're not as confident, then you end up doing things multiple times, or you do something that necessarily is maybe redundant with something you already did. And so I think that the hardest thing is sometimes just the actual decision making. It's not the physical feats that we're doing, though obviously there are some surgeons in our field who are just really, really talented. I don't know if you've observed the same thing.
Oh, absolutely. Surgical decision making is huge. I mean, I think it's as big, if not more important, than manual dexterity. And I, when I operate with fellows, I'm constantly asking their opinion, okay, what should we do next? And part of this, yes, part of it is a Socratic method. I want to know, you know, what they're learning and what they're gauging and how they're thinking. But also, I really want to know what their thought processes are in case they think of things in a different way than I do. You know, every fellow looks at things a little bit differently, and they might want to do more than they need to. And you can say, well, in my experience, I've had cases where, you know, this has been enough. And you can try it and you can see. And that's why I think also, when I try to design the fellow experience, I try to make sure they get as much pre and post-op care as possible so they can kind of see the results of all that's been going on in the OR. I think that's really important as well.
Yeah, seeing post-ops is an underrated benefit of being a fellow, depending on where you do your fellowship. Like sometimes I think that as a fellow, you can look back at when you're a fellow and you're like, oh, it's annoying that to say post-op month one or post-op day one. But I think just getting an idea in your head, even if it's unconscious, what is normal, what is okay, what isn't normal, what exactly do you need to look for? Some of that is just reps and seeing enough post-ops to know. Because I feel like every single post-op looks slightly different. It's like a snowflake. It's like, you know, every single, and some things are simple, right? If you're putting in gas and it's a full fill on day one for a superior detachment, there's really not much you're going to change on post-op day one. But just being comfort with certain things, I think, and we're going to talk about buckles in a second. For example, I think because people are doing less buckles, we're less comfortable with residual subretinal fluid. And so people are less and less comfortable with subretinal fluid, and they may be more prone to anxiety or even making the mistake of intervening when subretinal fluid can be well tolerated and can go away on its own months after, or up to a year after scleral bulk, even longer.
That's right.
So we have a couple topics we can get back to. Let's go back to what you were talking about, Jeff Tan's contact lens technique, because that's a great technique, and it's actually something that's easily described in an audio format. So tell us a little bit about what that is and what are the benefits, and just kind of simply summarize what you guys do for those cases.
Sure. So this technique originated when we were trying to do secondary vitrectomy on an eye with a corneal laceration that's been sutured, and it might have been sutured that same day or it might have been sutured a week or two prior. But basically, at an infusion of even 25 or 30, fluid was spewing up through the center of the cornea. And so we decided to just smack a contact lens on there with some viscoelastic under it and on top of it to basically plug the flow, and we realized the secondary benefit was amazing corneal clarity. So then that was how the bandage contact lens technique was born. If you have a corneal wound, or even if you've just debrided your epithelium and you're hoping to stave off that dreaded eventual stromal haze through which you have to look. It is very easy to just get a 16 millimeter contact lens, put a little viscoelastic on the surface as you would anyway, stick the contact lens on, and then put a little bit more viscoelastic on the top, and it'll really clear up your view and allow you to prolong the surgical time without getting either the epithelial edema or the stromal edema.
That is something, I think it was presented originally at Vit Buckle, if I'm recalling correctly, maybe in Miami 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago. But it's really really simple, but really, really ingenious, because, again, most of us will have access to both viscoelastic in the OR and hopefully some sort of bandage contact lens from our cornea colleagues. Yeah. Let's talk about silicone oil. Because you've given a talk at Vit Buckle about silicone oil, and you, it was a great talk, kind of summarizing kind of tips and tricks. I referenced the inferior peripheral iridectomy. Let's talk about getting the perfect oil fill. And there's multiple ways people like to get a good oil fill, but I feel this is one of the more common things either fellows worry about, or I've had fellows come back and almost be like, you know, I was so used to someone telling me what to do when I was doing my oil fills, I wasn't necessarily paying attention to everything that was going on, because it seems really simple, but it's not nearly as simple as, for example, putting in gas and exchanging air for gas in an eye, right? So what's your approach for a silicone oil fill? You've gotten to the end of the case. Let's say you're under air, and we can talk about whether you do direct PFO to oil, but how do you achieve the perfect fill for yourself? What Senestoke oil do you like to use and why? And then does this vary depending on whether the patient's phakic, pseudophakic, or aphakic, how you kind of approach it surgically?
Yes, I like variety. I'm comfortable with 1,000 and 5,000. I used to use a lot of 1,000. You know, when you have a young, active person, they will emulsify. So if you're going to leave it in for a while, over 6 months, it's nice to use 5,000. I will say that for direct PFO to silicone oil exchange, 1,000 is really nice, because you can use the passive technique with the back flush to do your exchange, which I find a little bit smoother. So I'll generally use 1,000 if I'm going to do a direct PFO to silicone oil exchange in the case of giant retinal tears. And in those cases, I'm hopefully going to take it out after 6 months anyway. But for many cases, such as patients who are aphakic and really severe diabetic cases, I'll tend to use 5,000 to try and delay emulsification as much as possible so I can see through it longer. But I think the key when you start infusing oil is to make sure that you're not fighting the oil infusion with air infusion going in. So I'll start turning down my air infusion through the infusion line. If it's at 35, I'll turn it down to 20. And then when I have about half of the oil fill, I'll turn it down to 10. And then at the very end, I'll turn it down to 0 and I'll just unplug the air, because the key is getting the air pockets out of each of the corners. So I will put the chimney in each one of the infusion ports to try and get out my air pockets. And then you have to specifically know if you're using, for example, a 6 millimeter infusion cannula, if it's been that sort of a case, to make sure you tilt the eye to get the air pocket out of that particular quadrant. With 1,000, a lot of times, depending on what gauge you're using, because I'll use a lot of 25, but sometimes I'll use the 23, especially if I'm doing an oil exchange with 5,000. I like to use 23, otherwise it takes forever. 1,000 will come up the chimney and come up the infusion line pretty easily on a 23 and even a 25, but 5,000 won't. So I do a lot of palpation of the globe. You might want to ask Jonathan Chang, but he has actually an excellent technique that I won't touch on here for determining IOP at the end of an oil-filled case. So that's a good technique. But you're right, it's critical, and every case is a little different, and especially in cases of aphakia, it's important not to get an overfill, or you could wind up with a complete AC full of oil and terrible pain and IOP issues, which not infrequently happen.
Those are all really, really good points. I think one of the things that I didn't really realize in training until very late was, one, that getting an underfill can be very unhelpful and bad. Mm-hmm. And you referenced that in your talk, even for PVR, for example, you kind of create this inferior soup of saline, inflammatory mediators, and getting an underfill with oil also doesn't offer nearly as much support as an underfill of gas, depending on how bad the underfill is, because the oil kind of forms because of the surface tension, and it kind of forms this meniscus. And the other thing was there's actually, like you referenced, there's so many things that go into how good your fill is that have nothing to do with how much oil you feel like you're infusing, right? You'd reference pockets of air. Like, those small pockets of air can make a big difference in your fill if you have residual air. Not doing a full fluid air, leaving fluid, you know, if I feel like when we're starting, a lot of us when training, we don't necessarily go all the way down to the nerve when we're draining. We may leave a puddle of fluid down there, and that may also contribute to an underfill. And then the amount of, I think, residual subretinal fluid or a choroidal detachment, for example. Let's say you said you referenced like some of these cases that are very complicated. They may have choroidals. That, you know, as the choroidals settle down or as residual subretinal fluid goes away, that may also, you know, sort of increase your vitreous cavity relative to the oil you put in, may cause a slight underfill. It's interesting you talked about using 5,000 more. I think that that's been kind of something, I think from the push where you talked about efficiency, the push for efficiency, people like to use it less and less. But I have encountered, like you talked about, emulsification is a big problem as well. And I found that once the oil emulsifies, it can be really, really hard, even with multiple washouts, to really get a good clean out of the emulsified oil. It is almost impossible to get all of it out.
Yeah. And one other technique that's nice if you get oil in the AC is just to take the VFC cannula and make a little, clear corneal paracentesis, like with a side port blade, and just use that to suck it out of the AC, because that can really get the micelles out of the AC really efficiently and much better than with your cutter or flushing it out with a cannula. That can be helpful as well.
That's a great tip. I'm filing that away because my goal is always avoiding that, but sometimes you can't, and so it's a good way to deal with it. Last topic, and then I'll let you go. You know, we're going to talk a little bit about buckles. Tell us a little bit about when you like to buckle. What do you like to use in terms of the band or elements you like to employ? What do you prefer to use? And then, you know, tips, for example, for fellows who are concerned about, I think one of the steps I was very concerned about as a fellow, because attendings were very concerned about, was, for example, subretinal fluid drain, and tips and tricks you've learned to kind of avoid complications with that.
Sure, absolutely. So I love a good primary buckle for retinal detachment, especially for children or young and phakic adults. And by young, I mean under 50. And I just want to clarify that I am young. So the visual rehab is pretty fast. So I love that. And you don't have to worry too much about tamponade agents or visioning positioning. I almost always fully encircle, and I use, my choice is a 240 band, which is slim. It's only 2.5 millimeters wide and only 0.6 thick. So it generally doesn't cause the diplopia issue, the muscle impingement, or lead to exposure issues, which I like. And then, you know, if I need an extra oomph, sometimes I'll use a segment such as a tire in a certain quadrant to really support a break. And then I generally cryo, and I almost always drain subretinal fluid unless it's a really shallow detachment. And for drainage, you know, my technique for drainage I love because I feel it's not scary. I use a 25-gauge needle, and I don't directly visualize while I'm draining because I just find it too cumbersome. I look for the area of maximal fluid, and I try to do a clock hour away from the break, and I enter the needle perpendicular to the wall of the eye, just anterior to my buccal crest, and I just bury the bevel, and I come straight out. And I like entering anterior to the buccal crest in case I just happen to cause a retinal break. At least it's anterior to the buccal and it's supported by it. And I find that when the buccal is already brought to its appropriate height, that that pressure is enough to drive the fluid out of that anterior break. And that's all the fluid I need to get out. I don't feel that I need to get all the fluid out. I just need to get a little bit of the fluid out. And I leave that little 25-gauge needle hole open. I don't close it. So more can drain as necessary. And sometimes I'll do multiple of these little 25-gauge needle drainage in case I see another area that needs drainage. And I really haven't had an issue with bleeding, and certainly not the way it was seemed to be rather scary to open it up with a large incision and cautery of the choroid.
When I heard you, I don't remember which VBS it was. I think it was the first one I went to, which was maybe a couple of years ago. When I heard you talk about this, it shouldn't have blown my mind, but it was so simple, but so elegant. I remember like when I was trying to drain, I would always be really, really conscious of trying to get in the bed of the buckle. But, you know, sometimes depending on, it can be tough to like get the right angle. And like just going, once you talked about that, I started going anterior, just slightly anterior. It's so much easier and so much simpler. And like you said, I haven't really had any issues where that's caused a problem. So again, I just got to thank you personally, because that's something I've incorporated into to my practice pattern.
Oh, thank you. And, you know, I actually also use that same technique for draining choroidals. Like when you get a really ugly detachment and has choroidals, whether they be hemorrhagic or serous, I drain with a 25-gauge needle, and it works quite well. The key there, though, is to have some sort of an infusion in place, like an anterior Lewicki infusion to drive the fluid out. Because the reason it works with the buckle is because the height of the buckle is already squeezing the eye, and that'll drive the fluid out. But when you're draining choroidals, you need that AC infusion or a 6 millimeter posterior infusion or something that is providing pressure to drive the choroidal suprachoroidal fluid out.
The final question, and I'm sure this is something people ask, is how you're using a thinner band than some people use classically, either a 42 or a 41 band for their primary buckles. So people's concern would be, well, maybe I'm not going to support the brakes if I'm not exactly on it. Like, so how do you reliably measure, account for parallax, and make sure your band is in the right position, especially since you're using a thinner band than most people are using?
Oh, well, Dr. Smitty Ellis said I can fix anything with a 240 band, and he's a great mentor of mine. But first of all, I measure in a primary buckle. I definitely measure and mark where my primary brake is. And I adjust the position of my belt loops and the position of my buckle according to where the brake is. And if it's just too posterior to go back there, I'll use a segmental tire such as a 276 style. And just give that oomph in that quadrant, just snip it and trim it, and it'll fit right in to where the 240 band is. Or a radial wedge, like a 135 wedge, that's like a finger that reaches back and pushes up against the wall of the eye, and that'll reach any break, and any posterior amount of break.
Well, Lisa, I just want to thank you for your time and coming on. We always end with a fun question. I'm going to ask you, since I'm on the West Coast right now briefly, you've lived on both coasts. You've lived in the middle of the country. You've basically been in almost everything except mountain time zone. This West Coast time zone is bizarre, but you've stayed on the West Coast and chosen to stay out here. Sell to our listeners, why is the West Coast the best coast? Why should we want to be out here? Because I always find it awesome when I hear, timing-wise, everything's great because everything seems to happen before you go to bed.
It's pretty funny. I'm going to say that I'm a citizen of the world here. I'm a citizen of the country. I feel I belong on all the coasts, and I wish I could be everywhere at once. I love the West Coast, and every city I've lived in has its own flavor and its own flair. But I'm not going to go East versus West here. I'm just going to say that... love the one you're with.
Perfect. Well, I'm looking forward to see you at Academy. If not, then in Bitbuckle in Vegas in the spring. Thanks so much for your time and for offering our listeners some education today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's been really fun.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 129 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You'll also find our blog, Equal, Rounded, and Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. Also on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. We have links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We are on Twitter at Retina Podcast. You can always contact us by clicking on the Contact Us link on our website or emailing us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback, both on things we can do better and things we are already doing well, as well as new episode ideas. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. Olmos Dekou for joining me. Thank you to Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Minacasa, and Angela Chang for producing this great episode. Finally, listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.